Before that one small step for man taken by Neil Armstrong, there really was a giant leap in technology and daring taken by NASA in the late 1960s, the very first time men rode the giant Saturn V rocket and left Earth. Author Jeffrey Kluger talks about his new book, Apollo 8, the thrilling story of the first trip to the moon. It's all new and all blue, next. Just about everyone knows that Neil Armstrong was the first human to walk on the moon, but the first men to see the moon up close were named Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders, the crew of Apollo 8. They left the pad at what was then known as Cape Kennedy on December 21st, 1968, for a Christmas Eve rendezvous with lunar orbit. So let's get right to our interview with Jeffrey Kluger. He's the science editor of Time magazine and author of Apollo 8, the thrilling story of the first trip to the moon. What I'd like to know first is, this isn't your first trip around the moon, so to speak. You wrote Lost Moon with Jim Lovell, the story of Apollo 13, which became retitled, as I recall, Apollo 13. What was it that led you back to going back to the Apollo space program and this story?
In some ways, this story always felt more relevant to me than Apollo 13 did, which says a lot, given the fact that Apollo 13 became very personally relevant to me once I got to work on the book with Jim, and it became the movie it did. And certainly I was struck by the flight of Apollo 13. Lovell at that point was my favorite astronaut. I had long believed that, you know, anybody could claim John Glenn or Neil Armstrong as your favorite astronaut, but you really had to be a connoisseur to appreciate Lovell. So for me, Apollo 13 was his opportunity to land on the moon, and that was really exciting for me. So that mission touched me deeply. But Apollo 8 touched me in a way that I think it touched hundreds of millions and indeed billions of other people. It was, first and most importantly, the very first time human beings had wrenched themselves away from the gravity well of the Earth and sailed across space and surrendered to the gravity field of another world. It was, as I like to say, the moment that we went from being a species of one world to a species of two worlds. For that reason alone, it would have been a hinge point in history, a pivot moment in history. But the fact that it came at the end of that miserable, blood-soaked year of 1968 with assassinations in the U.S. and riots in multiple cities, riots at the Democratic Convention, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, the invasion of Prague, and on and on and on. The fact that it came at the end of that year was an act of redemption. It was a gesture of redemption by the species toward itself. The idea that we can do this grand and transcendent thing, even as we have been so base and savage for the last 11 months. And it seemed especially sweet and especially serendipitous that it happened in the last week of that year. And of course, on Christmas Eve, it was the day they actually went into lunar orbit. It was almost as if we waited until the last possible moment and then hauled ourselves up, back up out of the abyss that 1968 was. So that stayed with me from the time it happened. I was 14 when I saw it, which is an age at which kids are, especially boys, tend to be, you know, very cynical and world-weary. And I felt anything but about the experience of Apollo 8.
This mission really was bold and a very risky move for NASA. Could you set the stage for the decision-making process that led us to fly to the moon at Christmas in 1968? Talk to us a bit about the NASA managers, George Lowe, Chris Kraft, Jim Webb, and how this decision got made.
Sure. That was actually, I'm glad you asked that question, because that was really what I surprisingly found the most enjoyable to research and write. I certainly knew that I would have fun writing about, you know, what went on in the spacecraft and what went on in the, you know, the great pivotal moments of the mission, firing the engine to accelerate away from Earth, firing the engine to slow down and descend into lunar orbit, and on and on and on. But this, the exercise in what could seem like hubris, the exercise in sheer brass of making this decision and the thought processes of the people behind it, was really in some ways what captured me most. NASA obviously was operating under President Kennedy's audacious but not entirely unrealistic deadline to have Americans on the moon by the end of the 1960s. And they were on a good pace to do that. The Gemini program ended in late 1966, which gave us a full 3+ years to get the Apollo program going and get human beings on the moon. And the first Apollo mission was supposed to launch in February of 1967, so we were exactly on track. Then, of course, January 27th, 1967, came the tragedy of the Apollo 1 fire. Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee were killed on the launch pad in the spacecraft that they were supposed to be taking into orbit just a few weeks later. It was, in some ways, both an accident and, metaphorically speaking, a crime, because people at NASA pretty much knew that the Apollo was a jalopy. They pretty much knew that it was not the kind of quality vehicle the Mercury and the Gemini spacecraft had been, and it was poised for a disaster, if not then, then sometime later. It would take at least 20 months to rebuild the spacecraft from the floor studs up and to make it flight worthy again. So here we were in the summer of 1968. At this point, you know, you've got about 16 months left to beat Kennedy's deadline, and the first flight of the Apollo is a couple of months away at the very earliest. And the plan then had been for a lunar orbit, for an Earth orbital mission, rather, with just the Apollo service and command module, basically the orbiting mothership, then another mission in Earth orbit with both the Apollo command service module and the lunar module, then yet another mission with the same configuration, but maybe flying some higher altitude maneuvers, and then slowly stair-stepping your way out to the moon. Well, that was the smart and prudent way to do it, but it would also get us there well past 1970. So in the summer of 1968, late July, early August, nobody ever recalled the precise date. George Lowe, who was one of the ranking administrators at NASA, called Chris Kraft and Bob Gilruth into his office. Two other administrators, whom I like to say he outranked in terms of seniority, but not necessarily in terms of imagination. And he called them in, sat them down, and said, effectively, you know our schedule. Let's screw our schedule. Let's go to the moon in 16 weeks, and let's let Apollo 8 do it. It was, in some ways, less outrageous than it seemed, because part of the problem they were having was that while the command service module, the orbiter, was moving along fairly briskly at that point, and it looked like the problems had been worked out, the lunar module, the lander, was nowhere near flight-worthy. So even if they flew that first flight with the orbiter in Earth orbit, they'd have nothing left to do but repeat that one. So the decision was made, let's give the LEM time to go into development. Let's fly the first flight of the lunar module, of the command service module, in Earth orbit in October. And if that works, send these guys out to orbit the moon in December. And they did it. Now, that meant a 16-week sprint to work out the final problems with the Apollo spacecraft, to work out lingering problems with the Saturn V rocket, to develop the software, which was only operating in a relatively rudimentary state, to navigate out there and conduct all the navigational maneuvers that would be necessary on the way to settle them into orbit, and then to bring them home safely. It was an act of daring. It was an act of both madness and inspiration, and they pulled it off.
And we should mention that, you know, because the lunar module was not available, they didn't take it with them. And, you know from your own book about Apollo 13, the lunar module became the lifeboat that got the crew back safely. And they had no such lifeboat with them on Apollo 8.
That's right. That's right. So they were entirely dependent on the engine systems and on the life support systems and the navigational systems of the Apollo orbiter. And what caused the greatest concern, actually a grim sort of a dark, shadowy concern, was not so much that the engine would fail, the main engine would fail getting them into lunar orbit, because if the engine just quit on them, they were on what was called a free return trajectory, which meant they would have simply whipped around the far side of the moon, and the gravity of the moon would have thrown the spacecraft home. I say in the book it's a little bit like an around the horn toss from shortstop to second to first. If they got into orbit, though, and if the engine then failed and couldn't break them out of orbit, then the crew would have been doomed to circle the moon eternally, because there's no atmosphere on the moon that can cause the slow, steady drag that eventually causes all spacecraft to orbit the Earth, to fall back down, that causes the orbit to decay. That doesn't happen on the moon. So the astronauts would have been circling the moon eternally, as the moon circled the Earth eternally. And as at least one of the wives pointed out, they would have effectively ruined the moon for everybody, because nobody could ever look at the moon again and not think of those three men inside that $100 million sarcophagus forever orbiting. That was the darkest fear. The other fear, obviously, that the environmental system would fail, as it did on Apollo 13, that was terrifying enough. But this idea of stranding them out there really made people uneasy.
And when you mention the wife, you're talking about Susan Borman. And she took that concern to Chris Kraft, didn't she?
She did. She did. And Susan doesn't get enough credit, I think, for the toughness she showed. A lot of people like to say that Susan was edgy, Susan was nervous, Susan was given to brooding, and, she may have been more openly emotional than a lot of the other wives. But she was tough, and she was realistic, and she accepted risks, and she demanded answers. And for that reason, as much as anything else, she got along with Chris Kraft, who was profane and irascible and brilliant and just brutally candid. And she buttonholed him before the crew left. I think it was at a cocktail party of some kind that was being held at one of the astronauts' homes. And she said, "Tell me the truth. What are their odds of coming back?" And he looked back at her and said, "You really want to know that, don't you?" And she said, "I do. And you know I do." And he said, "All right, how's 50-50? And Susan said she expected as much. In fact, Frank Borman told me that Susan later said she was actually a little bit relieved, because she thought it was going to be 20-80, with 20 being the odds that they would make it home and 80 being the odds that they never would.
Wow. I remember asking Chris Kraft in 2001, what was your favorite mission? I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours. And he said, well, the most important one for the flight controllers was, of course, Apollo 13. And, Apollo 11 was the most historic. But he said, but my favorite mission was Apollo 8. And I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah. And Gene Kranz said something akin to that. Kranz actually was the beneficiary of a fortuitous bit of scheduling. He was, of course, the flight controller who was famously on console, portrayed by Ed Harris in Apollo 13. He was lead flight director on Apollo 11. But by that point, he had become such an essential figure in NASA that he couldn't be spared for every flight. So he was working an odd, even rotation, meaning that he would not work the even-numbered flights, that he would use that time to take care of his other responsibilities at NASA and also prepare for the flight to come. And he said he very much liked that, because to him, Apollo 8 was so historic, was such a transition point for the human species, that he was happy to be where he was happiest, which was mission control, but not to have all of the responsibilities of the flight director. He said he could watch and sit back and be on call if he was needed, but just take in history as it was happening.
Let's talk about the three remarkable men that were the crew of Apollo 8, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders. They're still alive, and amazingly, they're all still married to the same wives they had back in 1968, which, given the divorce rate of the astronauts, is really remarkable. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of each of them.
They are all remarkable men, and as you point out, they are—they make up what's known as the original wives' crew. There is no other intact crew in the Apollo space program, or crew with intact marriages, apart from the Apollo 8 crew. Borman, I found interesting. He is very candid about the fact that at the time, and even to an extent now, he was very much a grind, very much a West Point hard charger, very mission-oriented, deeply patriotic. He very much wanted to fight in the Korean War. He trained to fight in the Korean War and then was grounded for a year due to an eardrum problem. And by the time he was put back on flight status, the next incoming class of flyers were being rotated into Korea. So he missed his window. When he was assigned to Apollo 8, he took that mission as a critical battle in the Cold War. Yes, yes, it was a chance to make history and go to another world and be Christopher Columbus or whatever people would want to call him later. But to him, it was a battle, and he was going to fly out there, he was going to punch Russia in the nose, and he was going to come home, and that was going to be it. And that's the biggest reason he never stayed in the flight rotation. He retired after that. He figured, I've done my job. I close the final 60 miles and walk on the moon. That's just showman stuff. He said, my mission is finished. And he remains that way, as I say in the author's notes of the book. I phoned him once in the summer of 2016 when I was doing some final edits on the book, and he was 88 at the time. He's just about to turn 89. And he said to me, oh, I'm glad you caught me now. An hour ago, I was up flying a smoke spotting mission around Billings, Montana, because it's fire season and I like to, look out for people. It's an 88-year-old man. He still feels he has a job to do, and that job involves flying. Anders was very much an explorer. Anders was very much an engineer. He loved the machinery of the spacecraft, and for him, the greatest tragedy was that he didn't get to fly the lunar module. He had made himself an expert on the lunar module. He knew that machine down to its last fine filament of wire, and yet there was no lunar module on this mission. So he made himself instead an autodidact expert on the command module and also an expert on lunar geology and cartography and photography, because that was his job on the mission. And obviously it was much more than simply assembling the scrapbook for the mission for Apollo 8. It was looking for landing sites and learning as much as they could about the lunar surface from orbit. Lovell, whom I know the best of all, obviously, I've known Jim and the whole Lovell family for going on 25 years now. Jim was never so happy as when he was in space, and never so happy in space as when he was doing something crazy and outrageous and brilliant, like flying to the moon before anyone else ever could. He loved Apollo 8. Just recently, I emailed him and told him, I said, all right, I'm sending the book out, and, I wanted to forewarn him. I said, look, Apollo 13 was very much the Lovell story. Apollo 8 is, Borman is the focus, so, I don't want you to feel like I'm shifting my loyalties. And I knew he wouldn't. Jim is he's a pretty transcendent guy. And he wrote back and playfully said, all right, as long as you remember to tell people that I navigated those characters to the moon, I'll be fine. So he has some levity about it, but he also very much loved that navigation work. It was a tricky bit of flying, and he loved to do it. And you know, I think he's kept that lightness of spirit with him all these years. I've never seen anything trouble him. Borman himself said, you know, the watchword among the astronauts, if you're going to sum various ones, sum them up with a single phrase, he said, people just assumed if you can't get along with Lovell, you can't get along with anybody.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. I'm Dave Schlum. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the 1968 mission of Apollo 8 with author Jeffrey Kluger. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue our interview with Jeffrey Kluger. His new book, Apollo 8, tells the story of the very first mission to the moon in December of 1968. Some interesting characters show up in the book. For example, Vince Lombardi. I would never have expected to find him in the story of Apollo 8. Could you briefly tell us about him?
Yeah, he was the coach of... He was the assistant coach. And... Frank Borman was the equipment manager and basically the team manager, which was a lot more than managing equipment. It also, you know, he also handled the road trips and all the logistics. And he worked with the head coach, and I've forgotten his name now, Ernie Blalick or Earl Blalick, I forget what. This is how things elude me not long after I've written a book. And what Borman was affected by those two coaches in different ways because... Lombardi, as people remember, was just a passionate, colorful, charismatic man, loud and boisterous and inspiring on the sidelines. And Blalick was the precise opposite. He was the cool tactician who showed little and thought deeply and long. And Borman wound up admiring Lombardi's passion and picking up as much of it as he could, but he had to admit that he was more like the coach of the team, Blalick. He thought that's my way of thinking, that's my way of field generaling. But I think he picked up a little bit from both of them. And you know, by the time he flew to the moon, well, I mean, Vince Lombardi had already won the first two Super Bowls, so he was something of a landmark.
Let's close with the pivotal highlight moment of the mission, Christmas Eve, orbiting the moon, that iconic broadcast. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, the astronauts had a couple of broadcasts before that in their outward bound journey, and they had, you know, they had attracted an enormous worldwide audience. It was hundreds of millions of people. But NASA suspected, even before they left, that the mission timing being what it was, they would have a broadcast that could come on Christmas Eve, 9 p.m. East Coast time, roughly 9 p.m. And they estimated that they could perhaps attract an audience of 1 billion people. Well, there were half as many people in the world then as there are now, about 3.5 billion, which means close to one of out of every three human beings on the planet was going to be watching this broadcast. So they were told by the chief public affairs officer of NASA, his words were, do something appropriate. And Borman said that he said, well, that's great. What do you suggest? And the guy shrugged and said, something appropriate. And it was someone from the American Information Agency, and actually his wife, who came up with the idea of, on Christmas Eve, let the astronauts say what they want to say, let them give whatever travelogue they wanted to give, but then close with readings from Genesis. Now, I watched that happen, I was a kid watching that happen. I didn't know that Genesis was coming. All I saw was that it was Christmas Eve. The moon was on my TV screen. The image was in the shape, the semi-rhomboid shape of the Apollo window. But you could still see the curve of the moon. You could see the motion of the moon as the astronauts arced over it. You heard their voices coming across a 250,000 miles of space. When they closed with Genesis, look, you could be a person of faith, you could be an atheist. Didn't matter. Those words are their own form of freestanding poetry, and they are poetry that speaks of birth. And in that most murderous year, it was rebirth. If you didn't feel moved by that, if you weren't touched by the sheer audacity and sheer lyricism of what they were doing, you had no heart. Nobody could watch that and come away unmoved. And when they closed with Borman saying, and from the crew of Apollo 8, we want to wish you good luck, good night, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth. Well, they are simple and incredibly powerful words. It was no surprise then that when they came home and brought the world another gift, the Earthrise photo, the photo that's credited with turbocharging the environmental movement in the early 1970s, you know, it was no surprise that the mission became the landmark moment it was.
This is such a well-known story, and I've read about it, and there's, of course, the From the Earth to the Moon documentary, right. The miniseries, and 1968 episode. The story's been told before, but that you come at it with such a great, fresh, exciting take. Was there something that you learned that was surprising to you, one thing that you could share with us?
I think, again, it was what it took inside NASA to have the courage to make this decision. You know, NASA had, and the Apollo spacecraft had, 3 deaths on its rap sheet at this point. And yet, the people responsible for getting these guys to the moon, and there were 400,000 people, all the way from the person on the factory floor in the most sub of the subcontractors up to the 3 guys in the spacecraft, every single one of them was monomaniacally committed to mission. The country was monomaniacally committed to mission, and I guess I knew that in an abstract way. But watching that unfold, reading how the work was done, interviewing people or reading the fantastic oral histories that are on file at NASA, and hearing people recount, the brass at NASA, the various administrators recount how they were brought into an office one by one, and this great secret was revealed to them. We're going to be going to the moon in 16 weeks. And to a man, and they were all men at the time, to a man, they had the same initial response, which was, you can't do that. Those were actually Kraft's words, 3 words, can't do that. He didn't even put the U on it. And then they stopped and thought, well, why can't we? And one by one, person by person, administrator by administrator, they tumbled for this idea. And I think that was what I knew historically and broadly had to have happened. But to read it and read how it happened and read how practical engineers were happily seduced by the sheer courage, the sheer brass of what they were doing, that really touched me.
Thanks again to our guest, Jeffrey Kluger, author of Apollo 8, the thrilling story of the first trip to the moon. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. Our communications director is Casey Gardner. Our engineer and co-producer Nolan Ford is a bit too young to remember 1968, but he and I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.